Okay, this is take two, side one. Fred Hunhart and Vic Strecker, and we're talking about the men's club at MSU.
Yes. And Al Gurman, who's really part of our circle, went to Long Beach State College, was the head of the program, wrote that the police were rousting crap shooters, poker players all day long, and then when they got off, they would go to this veterans post and do the same thing. He said they had slot machines with payouts, they had money poker, and crap tables, the whole works. And he wrote this piece, and Chief Parker at that time, the reform chief, said, no officer of the Los Angeles Police Department will any longer attend the program at Long Beach State College. He was trying to kill the program off. So they were going to Los Angeles State College then, which was run by one of his former officers. And Al lost his directorship at Long Beach because of pressure from Parker. But, you know, when we heard about that, Brennan's reaction was, Al, you know, it's that Jesuit training. He and Frank, they would talk about that Jesuit training having come out of St. John's. And he said, it's that Jesuit training, he's a moral man, and he goes right down that path. And that's what Al Gurman did. He decided to become a gadfly. Because he decided there was a role for one in this field, and it would make it easier for all the rest of us if some guy gets out there on point and takes the arrows, and then the rest of us can open the parameters a little bit too. And he's right about that. There's no question that he had a capacity for adding to moral tone. He did that all the time he was at Michigan State in the school. And he would come up to the faculty club. He wasn't a regular with Houts and Ralph and me, but he would come up there and join us and eat with us. And so would Brennan and Day now and then. But we were in each other's homes playing poker and eating sandwiches together. And all of that, the faculty men's club was a great institution for our school at that time. Even though we had to walk all the way across the campus to get there, we did it every day, rain or shine, snow. I don't think a day went by after a certain point in my time there that we did anything else, unless someone was traveling.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite wonderful. We talked about so many interesting things. Houts was a little bit like Ralph. He was curious and interested, and he liked depth. He didn't like the 1-inch thick stuff. He liked to get way down into it and find out about things. And he was an extremely thorough lawyer. So we had a great threesome, Houts and Ralph and I. Later, when I moved to Arizona State, I took the family out at Marsh, invited us. We drove out to Laguna Beach and went through all the security gates and all of that. And he had another room for us and all his remaining kids who were in the house, and opulent setting. His wife, lovely lady, and when he got a form of leukemia, she wrote it in a quaint way, wrote us all notes and said, for some reason, Marsh's bones are no longer producing red blood cells. And, you know, she kept us informed about everything, and we wrote back. But he would he was also, in some ways, terrified of cancer. One thing he was on a lot, because he read the medical literature so much, and the legal, and he would say, we're that close to getting it, to getting cancer, to nailing it, and working it out. And this was, of course, long before the DNA breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. But he was reading all the literature on it, and he had a fixation about it. He was terribly afraid of getting cancer. And it's ironic that a form of it hit him finally. But he dealt with that subject too, carcinoma, in his magazine, where it had some legal implication, because he was so interested in it. But he and Ralph and Earl Stanley Gardner were buddies. And I remember when I did my my master's thesis, it was on the Sam Shepard case.
Oh, sure.
In Bay Village,
absolutely.
Ohio. It was on, an analysis of the criminal investigation with an ideal type investigation sketched out, and then how this didn't meet the criteria. And Norton Long, up in political science, was my mentor. And he would go over with me because he knew the people in Cleveland at the Western Reserve. And so I got there, and I interviewed virtually everyone, and I got into the archives of the newspaper, The Plain Dealer, and I drove down to Columbus to see
Shepard.
And at the last second, his lawyer said, don't talk to him. His lawyers gave me the transcript, it was this high, and to keep. And they opened the way for me to get down there, but an appeals lawyer said, don't do it. And that may have been the guy who eventually got him out. The guy in Florida.
I know exactly who you mean.
Yeah, I'm just losing his name right now.
Yeah, he was even on the OJ case.
Yeah, high roller. But anyway, at the last second, I was in Columbus, I was in the warden's office, and they said, sorry, he's refusing now. So anyway, I did that case, and in it, I implied some criticism of Sam Gerber, who was the coroner.
Right, right.
And because he was in deep conflict with the village of Bay Village chief and the cop who discovered the homicide scene, and the homicide detectives from Cleveland, who had been loaned to Bay Village because they had just never handled a homicide. And the conflicts were enormous. And a guy named Paul Kirk, who's a criminalist out of Berkeley, California, did all the blood work. Yeah, he was a very big-time blood analyst. He wrote a lot on blood spatters, very precise measurement of where people were when this happened and that happened. And he testified in the Shepard case, and Gerber, and he just got into it. They hated each other. It's not exaggerating. And so at one point, I found criticism of Kirk and Gerber, and Houts was upset. I was just finishing my master's in 57, and he said, Gerber's a very good man. He's one of the best in the country. Be careful there, because he knows what he's doing. Gerber testified that the murder weapon was a surgical tool. And Kirk said it probably was not, from the blood spatters. So it was, anyway, I think I implied that they should have let the detectives do their work before the medical legal people got into it. And Houts said, be very careful. Be very careful. Because he's probably one of the 10 best in the country. He said Halpern in New York is probably number one, and Gerber may be number two or three. So, and Kirk at that time wasn't in the top 10 at all. So stuff like that was always coming up. And
well, just as an aside, what after your study of the Shepherd case, because I remember that as a boy when I was growing up in Detroit.
Yes.
And then I went to Case Western Reserve, and right about the time I went there is when they got the new trial and
they
was released. Acquitted.
Yeah.
What was your assessment as to who was guilty or not guilty on that one?
You know, I still, everything I've done on that case, I still don't know, because it was a bungled investigation. And my conclusion in my thesis was that we'll never really know what happened, because there were too many fingers in the pie.
Mm-hmm.
And they really, first of all, after the discovery of the homicide scene, a lot of mistakes were made in the first 24, 36 hours. And for the first few weeks, there was so much tangling about who's in charge that there's probably some evidence lost. They never checked some of the areas between the house and the lake. It's right on Lake Erie.
Right.
And my judgment is that the bungled investigation means that we never really will know. I think what really sank Shepherd was the womanizing.
Mm-hmm.
The jury didn't like that at all. When this gal, his nurse, his office nurse, Sue something, got on the witness stand and described their trysts in cars and in his office, in parts of the hospital, and so forth, they just went cold on him and didn't believe anything he said after that, because he had denied that at the outset during all the police interrogations and everything. So, because they were looking for a motive, that he wanted to dump her, and they had a battle about it. Well, I think it was so purely a circumstantial case that they just punished him for being a dirty guy. I think I felt nothing but pity for the officer who walked in on this mess, because I interviewed him at length, maybe a half a day, and he gave me all the details, and he just didn't know what to do. He right away he called a chief, and then someone called a mayor, right away. You're talking about small town politics.
Yep.
And then small town goes big town when someone says, well, who here has ever handled a homicide? Well, let's get Cleveland in. And Gerber wants to be in charge, and so forth and so on. So it was like that. It's too bad, because some of the Cleveland dicks did some pretty good work on it. And Gerber tended to discount it because they tried to shut him out, I think. And anyway, I really don't know. And I've been asked that 100 times, and I've always said, I really do not know. This bushy-headed stranger and all that, things like that happen. And they were highly vulnerable to a break-in there. It was customary for them to leave all their doors and windows open. And he was sleeping on the couch and all that, and probably was. He drank quite a bit for a surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And had a number of drinks and probably half passed out. I don't know. It's I've seen lots better cases.
going back to your work at Michigan State.
Yes.
How did you end up over in Vietnam?
This was one of the neat episodes. In 1958, I was called in one day. No, I was not called in. An announcement went out of Art's office that we are interested in having several faculty members join the MSU group in Saigon. We'd like to know who's interested. It went out to all the faculty. And I talked to Ralph, and Ralph said, well, I'm going to go.
Now, he had been there in 56, if I remember.
He'd been there a number of times.
He'd been there for summer, I know that.
He'd go over for short stints to get the crime lab started. And he brought some people over to study forensics, and he did some training over there, short-term stuff. And I talked to Ralph, and he was going to go. And Paul Shields at that time was working in the police training program, not in the faculty. And he indicated an interest. The criticism of MSU at that time was that in the police area, it was only MSU's name. We didn't have anyone from MSU except Jack Ryan there. And he was identified as primarily FBI. And then you had Howard Hoyt, who had been chief over in
Battle Creek.
And Charlie Sloan, who had been in the state police, and Bud Hanville from the New York State Police, and things like that. So the faculty types regarded these guys as hired guns, not interested in the academic side of things. But there was great competence there administratively. They had some good people. But they wanted to fatten up the MSU presence there. I think it was straightforward that. And so this thing came out. So I went to Barbara and I said, how would you like to go to Vietnam for 2 years? And she said, where is that? I said, it's Indochina. And I said, the French got beaten there by the Viet Minh at Dien Bien Phu. Remember that? She said, oh, yeah. And we just had our third son born, just a short time before, November. And she said, would we have servants? I said, yes. She said, really? I said, yes, we'd have a house staff of maybe 3 or 4. She said, my gosh. And she said, well, maybe. So I got her to talk to Arnell, as I recall. And I did more talking with Ralph, and then Paul Shields came forward, and I didn't know Paul except casual contact. And Paul had now indicated interest, so it looked like Ralph and Paul and me. And so Art had the three of us in and talked to us about it and laid the thing out. And Stanley Scheinbaum was running the business end of it out of Olds Hall. And we had to go over to see Stan to negotiate salaries and all of that. At that time, I was doing consulting for the St. Louis Police Department, sort of developing their senior staff, and I was a kid. You know, I was 29 years old, and I was in there teaching their assistant chief's administration. I remember, this won't get into print, but I remember that the chief, Joe Casey, one time calling me in and saying, you know, if I like you, he said, you've got balls. Because, yeah, I was dealing with these guys who were 3 times my age. They were, two of them were reaching 70 that year and had to retire as chief and deputy chief. And here I was, a kid, coming in and talking about management. So, anyway, I was doing that, and I was getting $50 a day. So we factored that into my salary for Vietnam. And I was really impressed with what I got, because I asked for it, and he said, okay, Scheinbaum. So I said, how much could I have gotten? He said, you'll never know. And I went home and told Barbara, we'll get $10,000 a year tax exempt. And she said, my gosh. I was making about $6,200 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, my gosh. So annualized it and added for what I was doing consulting. So we got that. And Barbara had some misgivings, but she thought, you know, I've kind of stuck with him and done all these things, and he goes to Detroit and he goes to St. Louis all the time and so forth. And so we had a Vietnamese student at that time working on a master's, and he taught me a lot of Vietnamese in the next 6 months before we actually went. And it was like three times a week he would be in my office. And then I went to the Foreign Service Institute for a few weeks and got their basic briefing. And we put our stuff into storage and sold our car and took our three little boys and the two of us for 19 or 20 shots, series, in some cases series, yeah. Like the plague shots. We had to go to Detroit for those and stuff like that. Typhus, paratyphoid, typhoid, yellow fever, the works. And little Johnny was only 6 months old when he started the shot series. And so anyway, Barbara still tells the story. We flew to Chicago Midway, got on a helicopter and went out to O'Hare, which was brand new.
Took a helicopter? Oh, that's fabulous.
Helicopter to O'Hare, got one of the earliest 707 flights to San Francisco. And at Paul Shields' suggestion, we had booked a passage on the Luralene, a luxury ship, but we got into an Aleutian storm, pretty bad seas. And so Barb and little guys were not too well some of the time. But we got to Hawaii, and then things were fine. But back then, no jets flew overseas. They didn't have the range. So we stayed in Honolulu a week, and we got a DC-7 with berths to go to Tokyo. And I remember a Philippine consul was on the plane with his wife, who was 8 months pregnant, sitting there. And she was very uncomfortable. So I gave her my berth and sat in a seat. And the stewardess hated that. The stewardess was really, really angry with me, and that I gave away a first-class berth. But I wanted to watch anyway, because we were going to land at Wake Island for refueling.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked the stewardess to alert me when we were going to go to Wake. She said, you'll know, because we have to circle a couple of times, lose altitude, and go in at such a short runway. So I watched this whole operation, and this looked like a postage stamp down there when we circled it, and a tiny little piece of rock. And went there, stayed in Tokyo some days. All kinds of adventures, trying to figure things out, you know, going to buy diapers, and they were about this big for little little Japanese kids, and, you know. Flew from there to Hong Kong on a Boeing Stratocruiser, one of those old two-deckers.
Yeah.
It was one of the last years they flew those, and I stayed up all night to look at the islands off the China coast as we went down to Hong Kong.
Oh.
And just to see it, And I deliberately got a west side seat, and I stayed up all night and into Hong Kong and spent a week or two in Hong Kong getting things, clothing for one thing. We were told, don't bring a lot of clothing, buy it in Hong Kong. If you're going to have electronics, buy it there. So I bought a stereo system at the radio people out on the island and things like that. Had a white suit made, stuff like that, because we had to have a white suit. And then we went down to Saigon. And I made a big mistake. I drank some unboiled water in Hong Kong.
Oh, dear.
I didn't know it. I thought the taps there were okay, and I got mixed up. They were okay in Tokyo, but they weren't okay in Hong Kong. And so a few days after we got to Saigon, I was pretty sick, and went to the hospital, and they did the checking, and this one lab guy yells, "Hey, come here and look at this. Have you ever seen that many amoeba in your life?" And, you know, I was just loaded with amoeba. And it lasted a year and a half, the dysentery.
Oh.
It was just a dreadful thing. But, you know, like everything else. And back then they treated it with an arsenic compound that affected your eye dilation, and so when you got out of a car, for instance, and stepped into the sunlight, it would almost knock you over because the eyes would not adjust very quickly. But that's the only treatment they had. So, but we went there. I got the job of handling all of the what we called participants, all of the people who were sent to the States for police training. They would go first for a month or two to what we called Mr. Smith's organization. It was a CIA operation called the International Police Academy in the old car barn in Washington. And they said former CIA agent ran well. He was a senior guy. And I taught there after I got back a couple times. But we'd send them there for some orientation, then all over the country to police departments to see how they run and so forth. And that had been going on since about 56. And so I took over that operation. And it was similar in a way to field training. You know, I had to set up itineraries and for detectives, for forensics, for undercover work, for every sort of specialization, communication, traffic. So I did that, and that was no great strain. And then we traveled around the country and did schools in the provinces. We'd go into a province town, and invariably we'd get there, and the province security chief would get us into his office, and we'd be there at 8 in the morning, and he would pour a glass of scotch for us. And at 8 in the morning, Their view of Americans was that way, you know, that we've got to have whiskey right away. And I couldn't drink with the dysentery. It almost killed me. But you had to make a showing of it. And on one of those training visits, we were in Quinyan, province security chief's office, and he brought out a bottle of wine with an interesting label on it. I looked at it, and I said, Is that Sacramento wine? And he looked and he says, "Oh, yes, yes." I said, how do we come by Sacramento wine?" And he said, "Well, the Viet Cong burned a church and killed the nuns and kidnapped the priest and went away, and we caught up with them and killed them and brought this back. So they ended up with the Sacramento wine at the security office and gave it to the visiting Americans." And I thought my dad would finally have been proud of me because I was getting Sacramento wine. He was always jealous of the priests, who were the only ones who got the wine in a Catholic church. the peasants only get the host. But
yeah, right.
Yeah, you just get a little.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So, anyway, he always said they get that wine. But anyway, schools around the country, when I first got there, we could go anywhere in jeeps, and we took a 3-jeep convoy all the way up the middle of Vietnam, Ban Ma Thuot, Dak Tho, Dak Sut, which is right, you could walk to the Cambodian and Laotian borders there. Mm. Nothing but rock piles, that's all there was up there. It wasn't even really desert, it was just rocks. And then back down to Pleiku and to the coast, and then up the coast road all the way to the demilitarized zone where we were not supposed to go. But the security chief up there smuggled us into a little bunker very near to the entrance to the Ben Hai Bridge. And so we could see that the north half of the bridge was painted red and the south side of it was painted black.